This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Archive Edition, we continue with our 60s Music Week.
Four gentlemen and one great, great roar. Big Brother.
Bill Graham came up with the idea of turning old theaters into rock venues. From 1968 to 1971, he operated the Fillmore in San Francisco and the Fillmore East in New York. Graham died in 1991 in a helicopter crash on the way home from a Huey Lewis concert, which he had promoted. He was 60 years old. We remember him now with an interview Terry recorded with him in San Francisco in 1989. It was there he first made his mark as the rock promoter of the psychedelic scene. Bill Graham eventually branched out into every aspect of rock promotion and was a producer of several groundbreaking international benefits, like Live Aid and the Amnesty International concert tours. He told Terry that when he opened the Fillmore, a lot of people who came to the concerts resented the idea that they had to buy tickets.
Music was chosen by the mass to be free, because to a great extent, it was free in the park on the weekends, and it was very difficult to tell the public also that many of the shows that were staged on the weekends, we provided the sound and the lights from the profits that we earned from the Fillmore. But the word business, any connotation of business or the law, the cops, the pigs, the fuzz, was a negative aspect of our society.
Well, how did you deal with that as a businessman? Did you feel like you had to defend yourself and defend making a profit?
It was by far the most difficult time of my life. The most joyous, because it was all new and was fresh, and there were no blueprints in how to run these kinds of concerts and how to deal with the public. The difficulty was in having the patrons look at me as perhaps the enemy, or if it wasn't for people like you, music would be free, and trying to explain to them that in order for music to be free, all the other elements that go into the concert must be free. Trucking must be free, electricity, telephones, transportation, getting the artists to the facility, and all the people that work here would have to have other means of income. But we all need to deal with the reality of life. Dealing with that reality at that time, with the power to the people syndrome, was at times very debilitating, and being the point man was very unpleasant.
Did you get into philosophical debates with audiences and with rock musicians about
every
how much
day.
Profit was the appropriate amount of profit
every
to take?
Day? There wasn't a day that went by. Why is the ticket price that high? Why isn't it free, or the whole spare change, and why can't I get in free when I don't have the funds? But I would always challenge anybody's forceful attempt to enter a facility because they felt it was their right that this should be free. Because invariably I'd say, what does your father do? And if he was a plumber or a baker, I said, well, I'd like to get my plumbing fixed for free. I'd like some bread for free, and tell me your father's address. And that hit a stone wall. But it took years to get over past that.
Was there a difference between the way you were running your operation and the way people from the counterculture who were producing concerts were running it?
Well, there were other people who were very sincere in their approach also. One of the things that I tried to do is to bring in music that they didn't ask for, but music that I know was important and became very important to me, if it was Latin or jazz or R&B. And knowing that The Airplane or The Dead or Quicksilver would sell all the tickets, I wouldn't have to worry about the draw. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go to Chuck Berry and all the Staples singers, as I said. And yet these artists had become, the film became relatively famous rather quickly. But it became famous as a psychedelic place, and that's where you, my God, if certain people touch you, you're never going to be the same. And we had the strobe lights there and the light shows. So it wasn't that easy to convince these artists. And eventually I had to go to Wentzville, Missouri, to talk to Chuck directly. I went to Macon, Georgia, to talk to Otis Redding, to convince him to come out. And when they did come out, the audience was their acceptance. To this day, my fondest memories of this business are watching a predominantly white audience look at Chuck Berry or look at the Staples Singers and look at Albert King or B.B. King or Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. Or we would bring in, we did a show once with The Birds and two one-act plays by Leroy Jones. And just, another time we did a show with the Russian poet Andrei Voznesensky and Jefferson Airplane, and watching the Russian ladies listen to the poetry and then watching them listening to rock and rolls. It was all new for me and it was all new for them. It was the most exciting time of my life.
As the businessman in the rock world, you were dealing with a lot of groups who were getting high a lot and who were into the counterculture. I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of groups who wanted to turn you on and see what happened?
Yeah.
That actually happened once, didn't it?
It's happened more than once, but it happened one time in particular where it was the only time that I ever knowingly lost it to some extent, just went with it. Yeah.
Is this the Grateful Dead story?
Yeah.
7-Up, was it?
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
They played the Fillmore quite often, and it was always, come on, Bill, let's get happy together. And I had a very strong rule about my work life, that during working hours, I was straight, and I expected everybody that worked at the film to be the same. And I pushed that very strongly, because we need to be clean and clear to deal with the public and the artists. And I have no right to tell them what they need to do, as long as they were civil and relatively humane. And in those days, I drank a lot of 7-Up. Just it was my liquid of that era. And it had gotten to a point where my wife, when I went to work at the Dead shows, when they played the Fillmore, would pack my lunch and put it in a bag and put a wax seal on it and take my thermos and just make sure that everything that I had wasn't tampered with, which is true. And I'd break the seal and have my lunch and touch nothing else there. Except some 7-Ups, but nothing else. Wouldn't eat anything there. And this particular evening when they were playing at the place, I walked into their dressing room, and it was just a habit. I would always walk in, go to one of the tubs that we had that was full of 7-Up and Coca-Cola and whatnot, and have a drink. And they knew this, so this particular night, unbeknownst to me, someone who I eventually came to find out who that was, someone had taken a hypodermic needle and stuck it through the cans of 7-Up in this particular bucket, and nobody else touched them. They said, that's the Graham lair. That's where he's going to dip in. And sure enough, I picked up a can of 7-Up, and about a half hour later, I was on my way to Mars. And I felt very good and felt very much at ease and felt very elated and very riding on a carpet. And Mickey Hart in the band asked
Grateful Dead.
If I wanted to come on stage with the guys, and I said no. I just introduced the band. He said, "Well, we'll only play if you come on stage, and here's a drumstick, and why don't you lead the band, and tell us what songs you want to hear, and whatever that is, we'll just play that, and we'll keep going all night long." Well, that night I conducted this the band from the stage the whole night, and just hit the cymbals, and hit the barbells, and played the cowbell, and it was by far the most uninhibited night of my life.
Were you embarrassed or liberated
Not
the day
at all.
After?
The day after, I just wondered if I had made a total ass of myself. But I didn't think I did, and I didn't remember that I did, and never went beyond the context of doing what they invited me to do. I didn't go beyond that. I didn't try to sing. I didn't try to shout. And and I didn't try to dance. I just I know their songs quite well, and just picked some songs, and they played them. It was a joyous event. It really was.
Did it change your life in any way?
No.
No.
But I had already become a fan of that scene. Not just the music, but the fact that these people, that the group never used to this day, doesn't use props. They don't wear tight pants. There are no hydraulic lifts. there's no tumbling drum set. And the people come into a space, they're all doves, and they basically come to enjoy themselves and partake in a sort of union. And I'm very much in favor of that.
Bill Graham speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. This is Fresh Air.